Fulton County Courthouse and Jail. I'll be appearing in court today at 1:30 p.m. to challenge a new riot charge against me, stemming from Democracy Now!'s Labor Day coverage of the Dakota Access Pipeline guards pepper spraying and sicking dogs on Native Americans. For updates throughout the day, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks today to Laura Gottesdiener, Mike Burke, Dennis Moynihan, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us.
And this is KBOO Portland. Good morning. It's 7:59. More talk radio is up next. Celeste and Cecil's talk with a local peace activist and Vietnam veteran S. Brian Wilson about paying the price for peace, the documentary about his life and work, next on KBOO.
We would like to thank the following restaurants for their ongoing support of KBOO Community Radio. Circa 33, located at 3348 Southeast Belmont Street. Bunk Sandwiches at bunksandwiches.com. 23 Hoyt, located at 529 Northwest 23rd Avenue and the 5th Quadrant at 3901 B North Williams Avenue. Thank you to Beulah Land Coffee and Ale House, 118 Northeast 28th Avenue. Cafe Hibiscus, located at 4950 Northeast 14th Avenue, and Sizzle Pie. More information at sizzlepie.pizza. Thank you for helping sustain our KBOO community and supporting independent, non-commercial radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Rents Tents Development. Who does the City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall in Portland? Rents, Tents, and Development is an election debate featuring candidates for Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly and Steve Novick. This event will focus on how housing intersects with other social justice causes and the candidates' vision of how we can take local action to change housing policy in our city. Again, that's Rents, Tents, Development. Who does City Council represent on Friday, October 21st at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland? More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Morning. Today is Monday, October 17th, 2016, and you are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO.
Portland.
90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in Points East, the Hood River. In Philomath, we are 104.3 and everywhere. KBOO.FM. Good morning.
And I'm Cecil Prescott.
I'm Celeste Carey. And we're here today with someone to talk not only about their life, but of the importance of one life making one stand that causes ripples. Ripples that cause sympathetic harmonies and strengthen all of us in not only our everyday daily walk, but in our spiritual walk when we decide that enough is enough.
Joining us this morning is S. Brian Wilson. He is the subject and the co-producer, one of the producers.
No, I'm not one of the producers.
Oh, you're not?
Director.
No, I have nothing to do with the film except I was the subject of a lot of the interviews.
Well, you know, Brian, they exalt that position, though, because your name is right up there with the director, Brian Wilson, and director, Bodock.
It's his film.
Okay. But it's still paying a tribute.
Yes.
Okay.
The film is entitled Paying the Price, and there will
Paying the Price for Peace.
For Peace, mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. And there will be a screening this Friday, next Friday. Some Friday, October 21st.
That's this Friday. Okay. It is going fast. It is going really fast.
At 7 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. That address is 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. And it is sponsored by a number of groups. We'll name them throughout this program. But we're hoping that you might be able to attend it, and it is at 7 p.m. So thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me, and thank Marcia here for having organized this screening, who is spending part time in Africa these days, and an old-time Portlander, but still wanted this film to be seen at the Unitarian Church, so she organized it.
So Marcia, we did not give you a proper introduction.
Well, my name is Marcia Myers, and yes, I have been teaching in Africa the last 2 years, and sort of retired from my activism in Portland. But when I saw this film last spring, I went because Brian is a dear friend, and I thought, well, I want to support him, of course. But when I saw it, it was like, wow, this is very significant. People need to see this because it's about the biggest elephant in the living room of this United States of America. Needless to say, we've got a lot of a stampede in the living room. But this is the one that really is never talked about, and that's the military-industrial complex. So Brian's story is definitely a place to validate a reality that we all carry within us. So I got all excited about making sure we showed it again. And again, it's this Friday, the 21st, 7 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church. And I thank all the people who are helping to get the word out. Don't miss it. Please do come.
Well, I think it's really important to come now. You mentioned the military-industrial complex. And for a lot of us, we think of it as being the big monster over there, and we don't recognize how it's how it permeates every aspect of our life, from being the military arm to go out and take resources from other countries, as well as the tool within our country to take resources from each other. And we heard Amy and Winona. Amy Goodman and Winona LaDuke just speaking about how the military was being called out to stand against peaceful protest to protect just something that's a basic right, water. And so I'm going to steal a couple of lines here from this flyer here. Brian, it says, Brian Wilson did everything that war system called right in Vietnam, and that it was all wrong. And then since then, for nearly 50 years, you've lived with the courage, and you have spread the courage for peace instead of war. And that means both war abroad and here. And first, thank you.
Well, it's all been an organic journey. It was not planned out in advance. I had no intentions of being an activist or a so-called change agent person. Grew up in a very poor rural community in upstate New York, and in the post-World War II era of consumerism and the McCarthy era, and my family, we were all anti-communist like everybody else in my town. And I was just growing up in that atmosphere, and I was a white male, which I now know is a big it's almost a disability, because you get to the point where you think you can do anything.
You can do anything. Well, especially if you're the right white.
Yeah, exactly. And I was a big athlete and active in my honor society and student council and church. But when I got to Vietnam, I had an epiphany of sorts that I kind of grasped very rapidly, that it was all a lie, and that the people I was seeing on the ground in these villages after bombings were real, authentic people, and I was not. I was an ideological robot, I think I kind of figured, and realized I didn't know much of anything. And I had a master's degree when I was in Vietnam. I was drafted out of graduate school. out of my second degree I was working on. And I was ashamed that with all that formal education, I didn't know much of anything about the real world. And I didn't know about racism and classism and imperialism and the savage way my culture operates. I didn't know much about history. But that experience awakened me. And so I became and still am a serious student of history, anthropology, psychology, evolutionary biology. I want to know what is going on in this evolutionary journey as a human being, and how did I get so, how was it so easy for me to follow an order to go to do something so criminally insane as going to another country to kill people? Because they were supposedly evil and were going to harm us in this country, you know. So it's been a long journey. And I was shocked initially to realize what was going on. I was 27 in Vietnam, so that was another thing. My brain was a little more ready for reality, I don't know. But I didn't really want this change, you have to understand. I wasn't looking for this. It was okay for me the way it was before, until I just couldn't continue in light of what I was experiencing, believe in what my country told me. It was all BS. And I knew that what little I was experiencing as horrendous had to represent something much bigger, a history, a value system that was really distorted. And so I've been 47 years on this journey of trying to unravel from the lie and recover my own humanity, which I'm still working on.
And that transformation, I'm sure you mentioned 47 years, so there are different awakenings on this process.
Correct.
But you mentioned, you know, your Vietnam experience and seeing the people on the ground, and recognizing the lie that
napalm people on the ground burned to death.
Oh, okay.
Children, mm-hmm. Majority children.
Yeah.
So hardly the image of evil guerrilla soldiers attacking the U.S. military, but actual villages where people are living peacefully. And this is the American brand of terrorism you're describing.
That's right. And that's how our country was founded. It was founded on terrorism against the Native Americans, and then against the Africans, and then against the rest of the world to steal the resources in the 20th century. It's built on theft. The whole exceptionalism, we call, has been built on stolen land, stolen labor, and stolen resources. And we don't know our history, so we don't have a context for grasping the level of perhaps of shame that we live with, but we don't recognize shame because shame is very deep. I think we live in a shame culture, because if we were to deal with how we were originated and how we were formed, we couldn't stand it. If we really understood the nature of what we do as Europeans, what we do to get our power and our land base and our money, it's beyond comprehension. It's unspeakable. And I just got a taste of it in Vietnam, and I realized that Jefferson's words in the Declaration of Independence, three words he had in there, it's merciless Indian savages. I had been in law school, so I was halfway through law school and I was drafted, and I had read the Declaration of Independence as part of my law school program, because I was studying constitutional law, and the merciless Indian savages were in there. And I told my commander when I left Vietnam, I said, I now know who the savages are. And it was not the Indians. It's us. And I was pointing my finger at me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, wow. And so that was my first experiences of trying to be honest about what I was seeing and sensing, and it was pretty shocking. But I was no way I could go back.
So it wasn't, because, you know, you mentioned that you grew up the typical, you know, America in the 50s, and it was a well-constructed narrative that, that we grew up with. So when you had this awakening, and I imagine things, your eyes were open, and things just crashed, did you have to recreate a new way of viewing the world?
Well, I was
not just the world, yourself.
I was despondent for a while. I was actually suicidal. I was a first lieutenant. I was in charge of 40 men. I actually at one point took my .38 and put it to my temple, thinking I was going to blow my brains out. And I didn't. I only held it there for probably not more than 15 seconds. I don't like to even talk about it because it's very, I don't know, it's kind of, emotionally it's very painful just thinking of that moment and almost ashamed that I would do that.
Yes.
But I had had an epiphany in a village where I was looked in the eyes of one of these Vietnamese women that had been caught in the bombing, holding her children. I presumed it was a mother holding her children. And I saw her eyes, which were open because the napalm had burned her eyelids off. So she was lying on the ground, and I was looking at her eyes, kind of in shock. I was throwing up, too. But I realized that she was my sister at a very deep, visceral, spiritual level, and that I was in her village. She was not in my village. And it was just this incredible moment of, holy cow, how could I be in this situation? And yet that's the situation that we've been in. We've been in this lie, and we follow orders in order to be successful or to be receive our credits, and yet we're going against our nature as human beings, or at least we're going against what I thought was a nature of justice and empathy, and which I learned in Sunday school, in Baptist Sunday school, no less, and realized that it's all BS. It's nice sounding words, but in the world of many different kinds of people on the planet, we are conditioned to look at other people and as if they're less than we are. And my motto coming out of this journey is, we are not worth more, they're not worth less. We're all one. Mm-hmm. That is the truth, and quantum physics tells us everything is connected in the universe at every moment, everywhere.
All the time.
All the time.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio. I'm Cecil Prescott with my co-host, Celeste Carey. We're speaking with S. Brian Wilson, who is a subject in the movie Paying the Price for Peace. He's also the author of his autobiography, Blood on the Track, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. Paying the Price for Peace will be shown again on this Friday, October 21st, at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. And Brian Wilson and the director, Bo.
No, Bo's not going to be there.
Yeah, Bo won't be there.
So, no, but so you will be there.
I'll be there, but I'm not, you know, it's not, again, I want to say it's not my film. I have no money invested in it. I'm not in charge of scheduling or... My filmmaker put in $100,000 of his own money to supplement up money he'd raised. So it's his thing. And in fact, he told me last night that today is the deadline for the Sundance Festival. So he had to get something into the Sundance today.
I want to say, my name is Marcia Myers. That it is that it's going to some of these festivals is very significant. It just delights me because, as I said earlier, the reason we're showing this on Friday at the Unitarian Church at 7 is because of the significance of the film. And, of course, as you've heard, Brian has had an just part of his journey there, an incredible life's journey. And thank grace we don't have to all go through the intensity that he has. But we can, of course, learn from each other since we're all connected, and I think that's what KBOO is about. So I want to stress also that this film, although it is focused on Brian, there are many other people that I find very authentic and real people. Alice Walker, she has a part in it, and Daniel Ellsberg, and who are some of the other ones?
Well, there's a lot of people.
Yeah,
and
just
actually,
a lot.
Daniel Ellsberg wrote the foreword, didn't he?
In my book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the title of the film would be more accurate to say, Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson and voices from the peace movement, because there's about 20 people in there that are interviewed, including Medea Benjamin.
Yeah.
And David Swanson and David Hartsoe, and there's a lot of people. In fact, it might be a couple of filmmaker critics have told me there's a little too much of that in the film. But I'm not a filmmaker. I just listen to.
And I found it very validating to hear other voices.
Yeah. So, any rate, it's a 97 minutes. Oh, it's a full length documentary, and. And I am woven through the film, for sure, as a central figure. But there's a lot of other people in the film.
So why is it...
Go ahead.
Why is it important for us to see the film this day? We're in the middle, 2016, in the middle of a presidential election. Lots are going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it... How does it speak to where we are...
Right now.
As a people, as a world, as a world community.
Well, Marcia might be able to say something, but I'll say that the absurdity of our political process is a distraction from really really serious human interactions and
reconciliation.
Yes.
All of that.
I mean, this our election process is the theater of the absurd.
It's the circus and the bread.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And it distracts us. It's a huge distraction from dealing with our lifestyle, which is the cause of climate change, really, modern lifestyle, for which we fought so hard in the mm-hmm. Cold War to maintain our lifestyle, which mm-hmm. in itself is destroying us. And that, you know,
which we were told it was part of our manifest destiny.
That's right.
It belonged to
that
us.
That is correct.
So every nation in this world was to bow to us.
Chosen. We were mm-hmm. chosen.
So we have climate catastrophe looming, which I say is connected to modern burning of carbon, which is our way of life, the military-industrial complex, which requires wars constantly to make money. They
as
will concoct
capitalism.
The wars.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's capitalism, which is the worst possible political economy one could create, because it's built on class, owners, managers, workers, and unemployed. They need them all. And this creates this disparity of income, and it never has enough, so it has to constantly expand. It exploits, so it's inherently, but you can't hardly address those 3 years. It's not; those are not being addressed in our political process, and there's no way they're going to address it. So those issues have to be dealt with by human beings. In reconfiguration, such as a Standing Rock Sioux, the Occupy movement, I don't know how it's going to manifest, if it manifests, but it's going to be from people who are not in political power.
And I want to say, I said this originally, which is this elephant, this huge elephant in our living room, and paying the price for peace is sort of a play on words in some ways, in that we think we are paying the price for peace with all of these bases. We were talking about how much military we have all over the world and within the United States, but that we pay 55% of our tax money in order to maintain a military all over the world, is insanity, and we don't talk about it. It's not on the table. Anyone who was brought up in a conflicted family knows what it's like to walk around afraid that you're going to disturb things if you mention somebody's drinking or somebody's abuse. And that's the way it is in the United States right now. And being able to go to Africa and come back, I feel it so strongly that when I come back, there's such a tension and stress here that we are living in this dysfunctional state and people are afraid to talk about it. This movie is very validating for the ones of us, and I know there, most everyone is aware of this at some level. So please do come and be validated for a reality that most people won't talk about, especially a politician.
And the military, a whole economy basically built on military spending, really for the last 50 years. And that spending sucks the money out of our society for dealing with our cultural issues.
It's not just that. It sucks our life out. We know we're producing something that is antithetical to life. It's like you were saying, Marcia, and we're walking around here in a state of cognitive dissonance. And so we have to be aware when we're being distracted. And I see your movie as being very timely because, like waves coming to the shore, you need to refresh that spiritual awakening and that connectivity on a human visceral level, on a spiritual level, so people don't get tired. Because we're not just distracted. We're not just drained. We're tired, you know. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO. Portland. The phone number to join in the conversation as we discuss both Brian's life, his book, the movie, Paying the Price, and remaining spiritually aware and connected, 503-231-8187. We've got callers online, and we'll go to Cody. Thanks for waiting. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I wanted to ask Brian how much more effective the distraction would still be if the draft was still.
Oh, my goodness. Cody.
And if more people had skin in the game.
Yeah.
How? Because he explained his life growing up and when he was in the middle of reality and how it basically shook him to his core. And how people have to be there to see for themselves instead of listening to the propaganda over and over and over again. I'm the son of a Sergeant Vietnam Marine, and he brought back the pictures, and he told me about maybe one or two of the stories. And they were pretty gruesome. And I'm here to say, how effective would this distraction be if the draft was back? And I'll take your answer off.
That's a great question. When the volunteer army came into force in 1973, which was considered a liberal policy, I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, out of the military, in my new life with quote-unquote liberals. And I was the only person in my group that was really opposed to the volunteer army. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a terrible idea because I knew we were an imperial society. And when we have a volunteer army, you basically have a mercenary army working for the corporations with the government drafting you or sending you off to save the corporate profits. And if I have always hoped we would have it, I know they're not going to bring a draft back. They know it would be a mistake because it would provoke dissent. It would provoke people having to think about when their family's going to have somebody taken out of their family and put into the military. Not every family wants that. Probably most families don't. So I know it's controversial, though, because a lot of my friends still just, when I say I would like a draft, and then we can organize against the draft. We can organize resistance to the draft. And we would. There would be no problem. We would be able to organize resistance to the draft. We would have incredible theaters of guerrilla activity, civil disobedience. It would be just a tremendous check on this carte blanche, go wherever you want to go. We have joint special operations forces in 150 countries bashing down doors at this moment. 150 countries. If we had a draft, there would be a certain percentage of men and now women who, once they were experiencing what they were being ordered to do, would say, "I don't think so. I don't think I can do this." And some of them would not do it. And in Vietnam in 69, we started having mutinies. At least 60 mutinies, I think, in 69. And then after 70, 71, we couldn't even conduct a ground war because there were so many troops that refused to do search and destroy.
Well, you know, there's some things that people would really need to understand is when you don't have a draft, then automatically that presses people who have the least options into the
That's
military.
Correct.
Okay. And the truth about what the military is can be hidden because it can be disguised as an educational or employment opportunity, and it can be glorified. And so then also when you have a draft, and we would be taking men and women, it would break families asunder in a way that would really make people susceptible to the spiritual awakening that a lot of these plays and actions would have. And people would recognize a lot more the cost of war. They would feel it a lot more.
And I'm always looking for the good news. And the good news here is the consciousness that has been rising in the last 50 years that makes this an impossible thing to do for the majority of people in the United States, the privileged white mainly, that they would not accept this.
Yes.
Whereas when Brian went in, it was the thing to do. So we are getting there, maybe slowly, but we are getting there consciously, humanly.
We shall see.
Well, we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Francis.
Hi. I appreciate you guys bringing this discussion today, the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex. And it's a tragedy every day for many people. And I don't know that it takes another, a lot of us who realize this, who realize the connecting between people, among people all over the world, and who realize that right now the baby's suffering in the Middle East, in Yemen, in Syria, in Libya, as a result of the military-industrial complex, is something that's very hard to accept and to realize is happening every single day at this moment. And what is ironic to me is that this issue, discussion of the military-industrial complex, discussion of the prison-industrial complex, discussion of police executing people in our own country, the global warming, the
all of the bad
oil,
stuff.
All yes, of that are discussed individually on our progressive radio station and discuss as issues that we need to address. But then when we get to the political arena, even on our own progressive radio station, it is promoted that we need to accept the lesser of two evils, which does promote all of these things because the other is much more fearful. There are people who are living what is feared right now from that other candidate. People who are living what we fear will happen if that he is elected. So we're advised to choose the lesser of two evils. This does not compute with me when there are people who are advocating and discussing every single issue that we are trying to address progressively as third-party candidates who are dismissed as people who are, will just be giving their vote to the worst of the two evils. I don't understand that. I don't understand if we can speak so passionately about these things that we cannot understand how we are ourselves being duped right now by fear.
Okay, I think we understand. Let's have Francis, I mean, not Francis, Brian.
Speak to that a little bit more about how us in this position are supposed to accept this and deal with this.
Great. Thank you, Francis.
Thank you, Brian.
Well, I think we get caught up in thinking that we have to vote. I don't know that we have to vote. We have to understand that our system is so corrupted that the political process is owned, basically, by big money, primarily military industrial complex money. And it's not clear to me that the automatic answer is that you have to vote for one of these two candidates or vote at all. I don't have a crystal ball about it. I know that I can't vote for people that I can't stand, and I can't stand neither of the major candidates. And Hillary is a proven killer because she's killed a lot of Muslims in Libya and Syria. And to me, it's, they're both just totally from my perspective. But I don't want to tell people how to vote. People have to figure that out for themselves. But I do think the idea that we have we call ourselves a democratic society is not true. We are not a Democrat. We're an oligarchic, plutocratic society, corporatocracy, if you will. And if we keep paying taxes and voting for twiddledee or twiddledum and don't talk to our neighbors about what we're going to do other than what we've been doing, nothing changes. We have to obstruct business as usual, which is what Standing Rock shows us. We do need to really understand people power, and people power is in the streets.
Well, it sounds as if, in terms of your response and what you've been discussing this morning, and hopefully we'll see in the film, is your awakening from the myth that we, those of us who are ingrained in this society, are at least born with or grow to accept in terms of the ideal of what America looks like. And part of the awakening that you mentioned earlier is to discovering, you know, what our society is really like, and then offering a challenge and a view of how we can reshape our society.
And a venue. You know, we can offer the challenge, and we can offer a view. We have to craft some kind of common language first, and I think that's part of what the venue is about. And so on one hand, I can see both your movie and a book being, the aforementioned points. Cecil had the challenge and the awakening and have you. But we need more places where we can discuss this and create that common language, because a lot of people are still confused. And one of the things I think is really important is finding a way to address the anger of those who are, I'm going to say this, it's kind of a weird way of putting it, understandably misguided and angry as followers of Trump. Okay, there are people who feel like they've been cheated out of whatever they think America owes them and America's status without recognizing the cost of that. And part of the cost is their own humanity, their own peace. I mean, you talked about the cognitive dissonance that you went through, Brian. You know, and I'm sure for a lot of people, some of this anger that projects them toward him is this cognitive dissonance of, I should have, but I don't, and why don't I, and who took it? You know, as if there's a scarcity of rights and resources. And you know, there's not a scarcity of rights at any rate, unless you're taking somebody else's, you know. So I can appreciate that we need this as a venue, too.
So, Marcia, what do you think? I'm not a very good critic of the film. How do you think the film comes off as showing the process of transformation, and then, I don't know, the the dynamic of the unfolding of the film.
Well, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, not being able to have a draft now, that's a real positive for me. That it does show the consciousness that is in the United States, that this has come forth in the last 50, 60 years. But I think that consciousness continues to rise. We don't all have to go through the trauma that Brian did, or that some of us have gone through, as we recognize the cognitive dissonance between how we've been brought up and the reality within our own families. So everyone doesn't have to experience that trauma. And this film gives us, we can learn through you. We can learn through your modeling how to handle things, because just the emotional trauma of recognizing how we're living in this world and the model that we are putting out there, I call it ability to respond. We have a huge ability to respond, which is responsibility. So as a white female in this society, I have an incredible ability, and I think we all have to take that. And I think that's what the film shows, not just with Brian, but several people in that film. So I think it's validating to say to you, hey, you can do it too. And I mentioned I've been in Africa, and in Kenya, the slave trade, it hit me there as I was going through a memorial to the millions of Africans that were taken. This is from the eastern side of Africa. That stopped after a few hundred years of people sort of protesting, when the people, the citizens, said no more. That's when slave trade finally stopped. And that's when this is going to stop, when the civil society says no more. So this film will empower you as it empowered me, and we don't have to go through the trauma, thank grace, that you have, my friend.
Well, I think that growing up in a capitalist society like we have is traumatic for most people.
Yeah.
I think it is traumatic. I think it's very unhealthy.
We have
psychologically
to live a huge portion of our life in denial.
Right. In order to survive.
A lot of energy.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I'm Celeste Carey. I'm here with my co-host Cecil Prescott. We're speaking with Marsha Myers and S. Brian Wilson, and we have callers who are patiently holding. Let's see if we can get to our next caller. Good morning, Rico.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say a couple things briefly. One is, I sure do appreciate Mr. Wilson. He's a humble person and very deep, and it touches my heart to have him there. But what I wanted to say was this term, the military-industrial complex, you know, this speech originally written by Ralph Williams, President Eisenhower included the term military-industrial congressional complex. Mm. He inserted that into it. But when he gave the speech, he dropped that out, and his brother asked him why, and he said, it was more than enough to take on the military and the private industry. I couldn't take on Congress as well. And the point of my comment is that I understand this thing about having difficulty with this personality contest between these two evil people. But I think, too, that, and not wanting to vote, but I also think that, well, you know, I want to vote for Bernie, and I want to vote for Elizabeth Warren, and I want to vote for John Lewis, and I want them to have as much power as possible. So I'll probably hold my nose and pull the Democratic lever as I did in 64 for Johnson. But I think that the issue really is focusing on the Congress and doing something to have them see the movie, to have young people going into government. Government has been so corrupt for so long throughout the world. There's always been one tribe that's taken over other tribes, and the white European tribe and Christianity has taken over the world with their guns behind them, and it's terrible. It's evil. And I appreciate the idea of being in the streets to say what's going on and to alert people and let them know. But I don't know what the next step is. We still have to be get together some way and pick our leaders. And so I would urge people to look seriously at the down ballot candidates and who might understand this. And I've said enough. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have a response?
No, I think everybody's got to process through this historical, I think, historical shift. I mean, both parties are now pretty well finished. I think both the Democratic and Republican parties as institutions have kind of self-destroyed. And that's good. The question is what will now emerge? And so there's a lot of potential for people power to emerge out of this. But I still think in general we are a society. We've been insulated by two oceans on both sides of our continent and relatively friendly nations, north and south. Mm-hmm. We have been spoiled, terribly rotten with our materialism and now exceptionalism, which is all, as I said before, all built on theft of land, labor, and resources from others at gunpoint or sword point. And it's karmically really hard to realize what that means for consequences in the long run. I think we are a nation of shame. I've said this for a long time. Shame because we don't. I use the word shame because I've had to deal with my shame. I've had to deal with my shame. I still have to deal with my shame. The conditioning is deep. And I was ashamed for having been in Vietnam, even though it was an awakening experience. It was a very, in a way, really awakened me. And yet, there's a part of me that wonders, how was it a good kid could follow orders to do something so absurd, so criminal, to travel 9,000 miles from my community with a backpack and a bunch of ammunition with a bunch of men to destabilize another society that I knew nothing about, except I was told they were evil. Now that really tells you a lot about the conditioning and the education.
Our programming.
System. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And so I felt very betrayed and angry, which is was my first emotions that led me to being an activist. My God, I was totally betrayed. It was a big lie.
We'll go to our next caller. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Oh, hello. Since we're talking about Vietnam, I was only like 13 and 14 when it was going on, but one of the cliches that came out of it, you have to burn the village to save it. My whole thing is there's so many different catastrophes happening, and I see the ultimate in political is the election of Donald J. Trump. Do you think if he became president and within a couple years into his presidency, that it would get a lot of people motivated, activated, like a national strike and stuff, people getting more aware of how messed up everything is?
Okay, thank you.
I hope there would be a national strike whoever wins.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I remember seeing war documentaries in World War II that occupied countries like Holland. In the early days, the whole country went on strike after they were...
I would love it if the whole country went on strike.
Yeah, well, for moral reasons. And because, you know, people were being shipped off to concentration camps and stuff like that. Sure. Not that that's not going to happen here. But there's just so
we
many
don't know that.
We don't know.
We don't know that at all.
It's a very repressive society.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm just crossing my fingers. But but right now, there's so many people into, like, football and into, you know, their narcissistic little, you know, what do you call it, hobbies and stuff like that, that if some things got really bad, maybe people might have a different kind of consciousness.
History shows that at some point throughout history, when people get to a certain point of misery and deprivation, they rise up.
Yeah.
So we can only hope that that happens.
Yeah, 1789, 1917.
Thank you.
1968.
And I want to say, as I said earlier, I'm always looking for the good news. And this is good news that people don't talk about very much. I'm a teacher. I taught for 34 years. I'm ashamed to say, talk about shame, around my fifth and sixth grade classrooms, all these white male presidents for several of those years. So,
plus a flag, I'm sure.
Plus a flag, you bet. So thank grace that I, too, have been raising my consciousness. But I want to mention, which no one ever does, the rise and the power of the feminine voice, which hasn't even been 100 years. And we have lived in the most brutal, patriarchal, capitalistic society in the history of the world and powerful. But at the same time, women and the feminine voice is getting stronger and stronger. And when I say the feminine voice, that is not just in women, it's in men. It's the voice that spoke to Brian as he stood there in that village and said, this is not right. So I want to say that we have to recognize and treasure and celebrate, and what it brings is a balance, and we are so far out of balance. So the feminine voice in women and in men, and then the balance with the male voice. So I just want to celebrate that and say this is the good news.
Well, we really need to be cognizant, though, of how that can play out in popular media, because Hillary is being promoted as the feminine voice. And we can celebrate the opportunities for women to be leaders, but we should not ignore the ethical standards, the moral standards, the necessity for compassion that the feminine is supposed to recognize when we choose our leaders. You know, there are people who might celebrate the fact that Thatcher was a leader, but where is she leading us? What are the qualities of her leadership? And so be discriminating and look at these women who are positive, life-affirming leaders. You know,
And men.
Yes. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, Joe.
Well, good morning. I just want to remind everybody who's voting for president, you don't have to vote for a Republican or a Democrat. You can write in Jill Stein. You can write in Bernie Sanders. You can write in Daffy Duck. But you don't have to vote for either one of those two criminals. That should be, both of them should be in federal penitentiary a long time ago for their crimes that they've committed against humanity. And the Donald J. Trump, that J should stand for jerk. I have other names, but I can't say it on the radio. But the point is that he's a criminal. He, I don't know how many deaths he probably caused by the stress of not paying his workers when he was supposed to pay them, if he even did pay them anything at all. Because a lot of his workers that were working on his projects were Polish, Eastern Europeans that he had drug over here one way or the other, and with the promise of a high-paying job, and it was not that at all. So they're both criminals. Don't vote for them, as far as I'm concerned, and write in Bernie, write in Jill, write in anybody else, but don't vote for those two miserable excuses for somebody in the human race.
Okay, thank you.
I think Jill is on the, actually, Jill Stein, I think, is on the ballot. I don't think you have to write her in Oregon, but I'm not totally sure.
Yes, he is, as well as others. I want to get, we only have a few minutes, and I want us to respond to where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. The title of the film is Paying the Price for Peace. People might be aware of, you know, your life, but what price do we all have to pay for peace? Because it sounds like it's easy for me to sit in my room, mm-hmm. and either call on the phone or write a letter, But is there a price that we all must pay for peace? Is it different for all of us, or do we have to be courageous individuals or groups?
Well, I do think that everybody will find their way and the price that they will be paying if they are earnestly interested in some kind of change or some kind of an honest understanding of how we live together as human beings outside of the system that we've been raised in, this capitalist system. I mean, I think simple living in cooperative ways with other people is a radical thing to do. I think refusing to pay taxes or living below the taxable level is a very important thing to do. I think going to the food co-op and buying local food is an important thing to do. Local. The more we can be independent from corporate products that come from outside our region, we are empowering a local economy that is not feeding into the frenzy of capitalism. But I think each person, I really believe if each person searches earnestly, they will be shown a way, whatever their way is, something that they haven't done yet, or something to do more than what they're already doing in that way. I mean, I really believe if people seek, they will know what to do. But you have to seek. You have to want something different. You really want something that's about justice and honesty and fairness. And you know the system is totally corrupt. So you don't look to the system. You look to one another and build a new society from below.
I want to mention the groups that are sponsoring our event on Friday, because if you want groups that you can really rely on as far as truth, integrity, and justice, the First Unitarian Church Economic Justice Action Group and the Peace Action Group are both co-sponsoring this event. Also, PCASC.
Portland Central American Solidarity Committee.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so proud of you.
One more time.
Portland Central America Solidarity Committee.
And Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILF, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I hope I'm
Veterans
not,
for Peace, maybe.
Veterans for Peace. Oh, my word. Yes, indeed.
We have a local chapter here in Portland.
And then, of course, KABU. Bless you. And all of these groups are ones that you can rely on for the kinds of people that Brian was just talking about. I hope I didn't forget anyone.
I think we got them all. Okay. And if you will, yes. War Resisters League.
Oh, yes. Those are the ones who say you don't have to pay your taxes, as Brian does not.
Brian, we have about 1 minute. I want to thank you and also you, Marcia, for joining us this morning and for continuing to inspire us by your life and by your example. A lot of people can write books, do movies, but very few people live out their passion. Mm-hmm. So continue your good work.
It's an organic journey.
An organic journey that begins with not resisting your conscience.
Right.
Yes. Because when you're spoke, you said, I hear you.
Yeah. So I wasn't looking for this road. And I'm thankful that the road came because I realized how ignorant I had been and what a disability a patriarchal mindset is. It really is like a disability because it preempts you from seeing clearly, feeling empathy across class and race lines, and economic lines. So I'm just thankful I've had this, although it's a hard road. I'm not saying it's easy, and I still have a therapist I see pretty regularly.
In this society, we all need one, and I'm thankful that you have one. So I want to thank S. Brian Wilson. I want to thank you, Marcia Myers. I want to encourage people to read the book, Blood on the Tracks, and see the movie, Paying the Price for Peace, coming up this Friday, October 21st,
1011 Southwest 12th Avenue, and the movie starts at 7 p.m. All this and more brought to you by your community connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO, good morning. It's 8:59.
That was sung by a prisoner during a performance in the Oregon State Penitentiary about solitary confinement. This prison performance inspired Within These Walls, a Portland community event. Here, Within These Walls, on Prison Pipeline, October 17th at 6:30 p.m.
I know why the cage bird sings. This cage is my stage. When I am on, I'm free.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Bill McKibben Lecture in Portland, taking place Sunday, October 23rd at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Bill McKibben, world-renowned environmental activist, author, educator, and founder of 350.org, will speak about climate action beyond Paris. Again, that's Bill McKibben in Portland at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. By some hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland.